And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, the war in Ukraine still wages on. And no telling when it's going to stop. And now there are those in Russia who claim that Alaska's really theirs. Well, we'll see how that comes out. Today's July the 12th, 193rd day of the year. 172 days remain to the end of the year. On this day in the year 70, the armies of Titus attacked the wall of Jerusalem after a six-month siege. 3 days later, they breached the walls, which enables the army to destroy the Second Temple. 927, King Constantine II of Scotland, King Harodada of Deheubarth, Eldred of Bamburgh and King Owen of the Cambrians accept the overlordship of King Æthelstan of England, which leads to 7 years of peace in the north. 1191, the Third Crusade. Saladin's garrison surrenders to Philip Augustus, ending the 2 year siege of Acre. 1470, the Ottomans capture Euboea. 1488, Joseon Dynasty official Chobu returned to Korea after months of shipwreck travel in China. 1493, Hartmann Skidell's Nuremberg Chronicle, one of the best documented early printed books, is published. 1527, Li Chenghong ceded the throne to Mac Dang Dung, ending the Lei Dynasty and started the Mac Dynasty. 1543, King Henry VIII of England marries his sixth and last wife, Catherine Parr, at Hampton Court Palace. 1562, Fray Diego de Landa, acting Bishop of Yucatan, burns the sacred idols and books of the Maya. It made him a lot of friends, I'm sure. 1576, Mughal Empire annexes Bengal after defeating the Bengal Sultanate at the Battle of Rajmahal. 1580, the Ostrog Bible, one of the earliest printed Bibles in a Slavic language, is published. 1691, Battle of Aughrim. Decisive victory, William III of England's forces in Ireland. 1776, on this date, Captain James Cook begins his third voyage. 1789, response to the dismissal of the French finance minister Jacques Necker. The radical journalist Carmel Desmoulins gave a speech which results in the storming of the Bastille 2 days later. 1790, the civil constitution of the clergy is passed in France by the National Constituent Assembly. 1799, Ranjit Singh conquers Lahore and becomes Maharaja of the Punjab, the Sikh Empire. 1801, British ships inflict heavy damage on Spanish and French ships at the Second Battle of Algeciras. 1806, at the insistence of Napoleon, Bavaria, Baden-Württemberg, and 13 minor principalities leave the Holy Roman Empire and form the Confederation of the Rhine. 1812, the American Army of the Northwest briefly occupies Upper Canada settlement at what's now at Windsor, Ontario. 1862, the Medal of Honor is authorized by the United States Congress. 1913, Serbian forces begin their siege of the Bulgarian city of Vidin. Siege is later called off and the war ends. 1913, the Second Revolution breaks out against the Beiyang government, and as Li Lehun proclaims Jing Kai independent from the Republic of China. 1917, the Bisbee deportation occurs as vigilantes kidnap and deport nearly 1,300 striking miners and others from the Bisbee, Arizona. 1918, Imperial Japanese Navy battleship Kawachi blows up at Suhan in western Honshu, Japan, kills at least 621. 1920, the Soviet-Lithuanian peace treaty is signed by which Soviet Russia recognizes the independence of Lithuania. 1943, German and Soviet forces engage in the Battle of Prokhorovka, one of the largest armored engagements of all time. 1948, Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion orders the expulsion of Palestinians from the towns of Lod and Ramel. 1960, Oryonok, the main young pioneer camp in the Russian SFSR, is founded. 1961, an Indian city prune floods due to failure of the Cotahuasita and the Panchette dams, killing at least 2,000 people. 1961, CSA Flight 511 crashes at Casablanca Anfa Airport in Morocco, killing 72. 1962, the Rolling Stones perform for the first time at London's Marquee Club. 1963, Pauline Reed, 16, disappears from Groton, England, first victim in the Moores murders. Now, for those who are not familiar with the Moores murders, carried out by Ian Brady and Myra Hindley between July 1963 and October 1965 in and around Manchester, England. The victims were five children, Pauline Reed, John Kilbride, Keith Bennett, Leslie Ann Downey, and Edward Evans, between the ages of 10 and 17. Four of them were actually sexually assaulted. The bodies of two of the victims were discovered in 1965 in graves dug at Saddleworth Moor. Third grave discovered there in 1987, more than 20 years after Brady and Hindley's trial. And Bennett's body was also thought to be buried there, but despite repeated searches, it hadn't been found yet. The pair were charged only for the murders of Kilbride, Downey, and Evans and got life sentences under a whole life tariff. Investigation was reopened in 1985 after Brady's reported having confessed to the murders of Reed and Bennett. Well, characterized by the press as the most evil woman in Britain, Hindley made several appeals against her life sentence, claiming she was a reformed woman and no longer a danger to society, but she never did get released. She died in 2002 at the age of 60. She'd been in prison for 36 years. Brady, of course, was diagnosed as a psychopath in 1985 and confined in the high-security Ashworth Hospital. Made it clear he never wanted to be released and repeatedly asked to be allowed to die. Well, he got his wish in 2017 at Ashworth at the age of 79. Okay. In 1967, riots began in Newark, New Jersey. 1971, the Australian Aboriginal flag is flown for the first time. 1973, fire destroys the entire sixth floor of the National Personnel Records Center in the United States. That's where military records are at. And I've been assured by the VA that all of my military records were destroyed in that fire. Now, I got commissioned in 75. So how could they be destroyed 2 years before they were even created? That's never been answered. 1975, Sao Tome and Principe declare independence from Portugal. 1979, the island nation of Kiribati becomes independent from the UK. 1995, Chinese seismologists successfully predict the 1995 Myanmar and Chile earthquake, reduces the number of casualties to just 11. 1998, the Ulster Volunteer Force attacked a house in Ballymoney, County Antrim, Northern Ireland, with a petrol bomb. Killed the Quinn brothers. 2001, Space Shuttle Program. Space Shuttle Atlantis is launched on mission STS-104. It carried the Quest joint airlock to the International Space Station. 2006 Lebanon War begins. 2007, U.S. Army Apache helicopters engage in airstrikes against armed insurgents in Baghdad, Iraq, where civilians are killed. Footage from the cockpits later leaked to the internet. 2012, Syrian civil war. Government forces target the homes of rebels and activists in Trimshay and kill them anywhere between 68 and 150 people. 2012, a tank truck explosion kills more than 100 people in Okobi, Nigeria. 2013, six people were killed and 200 injured in a French passenger train derailment at Brétigny-sur-Orge. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Birthday of the heir to the crown of Tonga in Tonga. Christian feast day. Feast of St. Peter and Paul in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Hermagoras and Fortunatus. Jason of Thessalonica in the Catholic Church. John Gualbert, Louis Martin, and Marie Azela Guerin. Nathan Felix, Nathan Soderblom in the Lutheran Episcopal Churches in the U.S. Veronica, Aventiolas, Independence Day celebrates independence of Kiribati from the UK in 79. Independence Day celebrates independence of São Tomé and Príncipe from Portugal in 1975. Second Day of Nadam in Mongolia. And the 12th, also known as Orange Man's Day in Northern Ireland, Scotland, Newfoundland, and Labrador. All right, let's see what else we've got. In 526, St. Felix IV begins his reign as Catholic Pope. 927, King Athelstan, and the first Southern English king, to gain control of much of the north of Britain when various local kings accept his overlordship at Iman in Cumbria. 1109, Crusaders capture Syria's harbor city of Tripoli. 1191, English King Richard I, also known as Richard the Lionheart, and Crusaders defeat Saracens in Palestine. 1442, King Alfonso V of Aragon becomes King of Naples. 1537, the Battle of Albanque. Diego de Almagro defeated an army led by Alfonso de Alvarado on behalf of Francisco Pizarro. 1542, French troops under Martin von Rossum occupy Flanders. 1549, Keats' uprising occupies Norwich, England. 1561, Trinity Church, now St. Basil's Cathedral, is consecrated in Moscow, Russia. It was built to commemorate the defeat of the Mongols at the Battle of Kazan. 1580, the Ostrog Bible, the first printed Bible in the Slavic language, is published. 1627, English invasion fleet of George Villiers lands on the Ile de Ré, forced to withdraw after 3 months of combat, losing 4,000 out of his 7,000 troops. Good Lord. Sorry about that. 1630, New Amsterdam's governor. Remember, New Amsterdam is now New York City. Buys Gull Island from the Indians for cargo. Renames it Oyster Island. Later became known as Ellis Island. 1679, Britain's King Charles II ratifies the Habeas Corpus Act, allowing prisoners the right to be imprisoned to be examined by a court. 1690, Battle of Boyne in Ireland. Protestant King William III defeats English Catholic King James II. 1691, Antonio Pignatelli elected as Pope Innocentius XII. In 1691, the Battle of Aughrim in Ireland. William III beats James II again. 1704, Stanislaus Leszczynski becomes king of part of Poland. 1705, Ottoman army officer Al-Hussein Ibn Ali proclaims himself Bey of Tunis, founding the Husainid dynasty. It ruled till 1957. 1730, Lorenzo Corsini chosen as Pope Clemens XII. 1745, warship Elizabeth joins Bonnie Prince Charlie's frigate Dutelli. On this day in 1771, the Endeavour, captained by James Cook with Joseph Banks on board, who was a botanist and an explorer, returns from his first voyage to the Pacific after 2 years. 1774, the citizens of Carlisle, Pennsylvania, pass a symbolic Declaration of Independence. 1774, Cossack leader Emelian Pugachev's army occupies Kazan. 1776, Captain James Cook departs Plymouth, England, on the HMS Resolution, beginning his third and final trip to the Pacific. 1785, the first manned flight by gas balloon in the Netherlands took place on this date. 1790, French Revolution. Civil constitution of the clergy is adopted, putting the Catholic Church in France under the control of the state. 1801, the Second Battle of Algeciras. British fleet beats the French and Spanish 6 days after losing the First Battle of Algeciras. On this day in 1804, former United States Secretary of Treasury Alexander Hamilton dies after being shot in a pistol duel the previous day with Vice President Aaron Burr. 1812, U.S. forces led by General Hull invade Canada during the War of 1812. 1817, the first flower show was held in Dannebrog, County Cork, in Ireland. 1817, Carl Drace von Sauerbahn demonstrates the bicycle course. 1843, Joseph Smith, the Mormon leader, says God allows polygamy. 1850, Dutch Second Chamber accepts the establishment of the provincial states. 1859, paper bag manufacturing machine is patented by William Goodell in Massachusetts. On this day in 1861, Wild Bill Hickok, reputed to have shot and killed David McCandless, which is possibly the first person he killed. He's later acquitted after found that he acted in self-defense. He went on to become a folk hero and have the Wild West show. 1862, federal troops occupy Helena, Arkansas. 1863, New Zealand British forces invade Waikato, home of the Moray King movement. Begin a new phase of the wars between the Moray and the colonial British. 1874, Ontario Agricultural College is founded. 1878, there's a fever epidemic in New Orleans. It will kill 4,500. It began on this date. 1879, agriculture and industrial tariffs introduced in Germany. 1882, the first ocean pier in the U.S. is completed in Washington, D.C. 1898, Jean-Baptiste Marchand hoists the French flag in Fashoda, Sudan. 1901, striking Canadian salmon fishermen on the Pacific coast, resentful of the non-union Japanese who continue to fish, maroon, and imprison 47. 1901, in Germany, a group of 104 aristocrats presented a deceleration against dueling, although that tradition will continue. 1905, the British and the Japanese renew their alliance of January 1902 for another 10 years and agree to provide mutual support if attacked by other powers. On this day in 1906, Jewish artillery officer Alfred Dreyfus is found innocent in France. 1909, the 16th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is passed by Congress. That's the power to tax incomes. 1912, the first foreign feature film exhibited in the U.S. was Queen Elizabeth, and it was done on New York City on this date. 1916, third and fourth of four fatal Jersey Shore shark attacks occur at Matawan Creek when epileptic Lester Stilwell, 11, is drug into a creek, and Watson Fisher, 24, believing Sewell had a seizure, is bitten while retrieving the body and subsequently bleeds to death. 1916, on this same date, Joseph Dunn, 14, is attacked by a shark. He suffered 9 fatal wounds in New Jersey. The final episode in a spate of shark attacks along the Jersey coast. 4 died over 12 days. In 1918, a Japanese battleship explodes in the Bay of Tokoyama. 500 are killed. 1928, on this day, it was the first televised tennis match. I bet that was exciting. 1933, Congress passed the first minimum wage law, 33 cents an hour. 1934, U.S. disciplinary barracks in Alcatraz Islands abandoned. 1935, Belgium recognized the Soviet Union. 1940, Frederick McKinley Jones receives a patent for an air conditioning unit for trucks, helped to change long-haul carriage of food and blood. 1943 saw the Battle of Kolombangara. That's the second battle of the Gulf of Kula. Pope Pius XII receives the German ambassador, Baron von Weizsäcker. 1943, the Soviet offensive at Orel begins. Also in 43, World War II, the Battle of Pokrovka. The Russians defeat the German forces in one of the largest ever tank battles. 1944, U.S. government recognizes the authority of French General Charles de Gaulle. 1948, the first jets fly across the Atlantic, six RAF de Havilland Vampires. 1950, the Hague Council of Anoma convicts German war criminals W. Lange's, F.H. van der Futten, and F. Fischer to death. 1951, a mob tried to keep a black family from moving into all-white Cicero, Illinois. 1954, President Eisenhower put forward a plan for an interstate highway system. 1955, the Christian Democratic Party forms in Argentina. 1957, the first president to fly in a helicopter was Dwight Eisenhower. Also in 57 on this date, U.S. Surgeon General Leroy Burney connected smoking with lung cancer. 1962 saw the first time there were two manned crafts in space, both Russian. 1966, the start of a three-day race riot in Chicago. The looting was so bad they called out the National Guard. 1966, Treasury announces it'll buy mutilated silver coins at Silver Bullion Price at Philadelphia and Denver Mints. 1969, as the marching season reaches its height, there's serious rioting in Derry, Belfast, and Dungiven. Many families in Belfast are forced to move out of their homes. 1970, Thor Heyerdahl crosses the Atlantic Ocean on the raft, Ra 2, arrives in Barbados, Morocco. Took him 57 days. 1970, Tanzania signs a contract with China for the building of the Tanzam Railway. 1971, Juan Corona was indicted for 25 murders. 1972, the Democrats nominated George Give Me a Chance McGovern for U.S. President of Miami, Florida. 1974, John Ehrichman convicted of violating Daniel Ellsberg's rights. 1976, Ian Drury and Kilburns disband. 1976, the first Family Feud game show debuted on ABC, hosted by Richard Dawson. 1982, FEMA promises that survivors of a nuclear war will still get their mail. Go figure. 1984, Geraldine Ferraro becomes the first U.S. female major party vice presidential candidate after Walter Mondale selects her as his Democratic Party running mate. That was a brilliant combination, let me tell you. 1984, car bomb set off by the military wing of the ANC explodes in Durban, South Africa, kills 5, injures 27. 1985, doctors discover a cancerous growth in President Reagan's colon. All righty. We've come to the end of this little history segment. We were talking about some of the crazy programs the CIA used. And when they were hunting for bin Laden, they pretty well determined he was in the compound at Abbottabad in Pakistan. But in order to confirm it for sure so they could launch a raid, they launched a vaccination program against hepatitis B. And the man recruited was a Pakistani doctor named Shaquille Afridi. Now, in the spring of 2011, Afridi and the CIA set up a fake hepatitis B vaccine program for children of Abbottabad. And they began by giving the vaccine to children in the poor neighborhoods of the city before making their way to bin Laden's neighborhood so as to not arouse suspicion. And this ruse worked as the people in the compound allowed Afridi to vaccinate all the children present. But the vaccine program was actually used to surreptitiously take DNA samples, which was then compared to one of bin Laden's sisters who died in 2010 in Boston. And the DNA of the children was a match, and the rest, you know, to use the expression, was history. But the ending of the story wasn't as happy or simple for all parties involved. After the excitement of the news of bin Laden's supposed death had subsided and details of the fake vaccine were revealed, the government of Pakistan naturally wasn't too happy. They were angry they hadn't been alerted to such a large, complex operation taking place on their soil, which, frankly, was understandable from our point of view because the officers of the ISI were actually helping bin Laden. That's their version of the CIA. Pakistani officials also angry about the deception of the fake vaccine. They really were not giving them vaccines. It's one thing for spies to pull shenanigans on each other, but when they start involving civilians and many children in this case, that's another matter entirely. But at the end of the day, the Pakistanis had little leverage in the case. All they could do was arrest the one Pakistani involved in the crazy operation. That was Dr. Afridi. He was arrested trying to leave Pakistan days after the raid. And he was tried for cooperating with an anti-government warlord. When he beat that charge, they charged and tried him, convicted him for the murder of one of his patients. Pakistani government since offered to exchange him for a Pakistani woman convicted of terrorism in the U.S., but CIA hadn't responded. Looks like Afridi was just another CIA patsy after all. And many experts point out that maybe the craziest aspect of this operation was the vaccine hesitancy it's created in Pakistan. Low levels of vaccination do exist in that country, and it's difficult to say for sure how much of that hesitancy this crazy CIA operation contributed. But certainly it's been a factor. Well, you know, we've seen the CIA pretty much has done what it wanted, when it wanted, and essentially made up its own rules. The only one that ever put a stop to any of their shenanigans was Kennedy, and you saw what happened to him. CIA was, for the most part, an organization that operated outside the laws that most people and governments around the world followed and did whatever it needed to do to get the job done. But even the CIA has its limits. There's an unwritten rule among intelligence agencies that heads of state are off limits for assassination. It isn't so much the CIA and its rival organizations around the world respect world leaders, it's more that killing them just isn't good for business. Assassinations tend to be mess in, lead to a lot of conspiracy theories, which is exactly the type of thing the CIA doesn't want. And a prime example of that is the Kennedy assassination. And the CIA hates how it's continually implicated in the Kennedy assassination because, whether it's true or not, it did shed light on some of the agency's nefarious activities. And of course, though, there's always exceptions. One of the biggest ones is the fatigue-wearing, cigar-smoking dictator, who's found just 90 miles south of Florida, and that's Fidel Castro. And he proved to be a thorn in the side of President Kennedy and later American presidents. And interestingly enough, there are supposedly were 638 missions undertaken to kill Fidel Castro. 638 assassination attempts, and none of them succeeded. Although not all these attempts have been proven or admitted to by the CIA, it's a pretty crazy number when you want to think about it. It's amazing to think the CIA, or any intelligence agency for that matter, would go around trying to kill a foreign head of state, regardless of how much of a despot he was. But the CIA attempted to do it numerous times. So what does this say about the CIA? Was it truly an evil, bloodthirsty organization, as a lot of folks argue? Or were its abilities exaggerated and it bordered on incompetent, as others say when they point out every failed attempt? Well, belief's in the eye of the beholder, so you have to decide what you want to believe. But there's no doubt the CIA attempts to kill Castro was as ridiculous as any other mission we've discussed. Let's talk about Operation Mongoose. We've already seen how the CIA had no qualms about being alone to itself. We've also seen how in the early 60s it particularly hated Castro. It was strongly opposed to his political ideology, but it also had a personal problem with Castro. I mean, after all, who did he think he was running his own country free of U.S. government involvement just 90 miles from Florida? We couldn't allow such an affront. He had to be stopped. And things got more and more personal the more the CIA and American military tried and failed to remove him from power. Now, the campaign to remove Castro from power and to eventually kill him off eventually began in March of 1960, when then-President Eisenhower signed off on a CIA document titled A Program of Covert Action Against the Castro Regime. CIA had the job of undermining Castro's appeal through a disinformation campaign that was coupled with the support for anti-communist dissidents in Cuba and Florida. But try as they might, the program initially demonstrated little success. But when Kennedy got elected, the anti-Castro program got a new shot in the arm. It gave the CIA a green light to move ahead with the Bay of Pigs invasion. And after that fiasco, they devised a much more intricate program to remove Castro through a series of plans and missions that later became known as Operation Mongoose. Now, even though they get crazy names for their operations, this one made a little bit of sense. Communist Cuba is viewed as a snake by the CIA, and mongooses, or mongeese, are small animals that kill snakes by attacking their heads. And the head of this particular snake was Castro. Therefore, the goal of Operation Mongoose was to cause a regime change in Cuba without a major U.S. military operation. Now, I mentioned the Bay of Pigs invasion failed. And the reason it failed is Kennedy refused to allow the air support he had promised. He was afraid that the Russians wouldn't like it. Now, Castro, for his part, was a crafty dictator. Had a loyal core of followers, commanded a capable intelligence network, and had the support of the KGB. So when CIA officer William King Harvey was given the lead on Operation Mongoose, he decided to employ tactics that were legally, ethically, and morally questionable, even for the CIA. Before Operation Mongoose was official, he employed American businessman Robert Mayhew to own one notable anti-Castro mission for the sake of plausible denial. Mayhew ran a private detective agency that cut out or subcontract work for the FBI and the CIA when those organizations needed to circumvent the law, which was quite often. Posing as a businessman with interest in Cuba, Mayhew contacted Johnny Rosselli of the Chicago Costa Nostra organization with an offer to set up the assassination of Castro. When Rosselli liked the idea and organized a meeting between Mayhew and Chicago outfit boss Sam Giancana and Florida Mafia kingpin Santo Trafficante Jr. in the early 60s, and this was to be the very first, but far from the last, CIA attempt to assassinate Castro. After the Bay of Pigs failed, Operation Mongoose veered away from intelligence gathering and overthrew the regime generally to focus on assassinating Castro specifically. After nearly 50 years of Castro's rule, there'd be some pretty incredible and unbelievable plots to kill him. CIA was desperate to get him, so much so that they seemed to have employed science fiction writers to come up with some of the assassination methods. Or maybe they were still using some of the LSD that was used in Project MKUltra. Either way, they came up with some totally crazy ideas. The starting points of the CIA plan to kill Castro were soundly based on some of his weaknesses. But from that point, they seemed to devolve into the bizarre before they even got off the ground. For example, Castro loved to scuba dive. Being born and raised in the Caribbean, he loved the ocean and in his younger years was an avid scuba diver and snorkeler. Particularly enjoyed diving for mollusks, which was how the CIA came up with two of its early failed plans to kill him. The first one involved CIA frogmen putting brightly colored mollusks packed with explosives on the ocean floor while Castro routinely dove. The thought was he would dive down to grab them, and he'd be sent to the workers' paradise in the sky, where he could philosophize with the ghost of Marx and Lenin. Well, for some reason, that didn't work. So then the CIA came up with the idea of infecting his diving suit with deadly fungus or toxin. You'd put it on to be absorbed through the skin into Castro. But they couldn't get close enough to his suit to do the deed. And the CIA didn't really care if others got in the way of their plots or if potential assassination happened in a neutral, even friendly country. On November 22nd, 1963, the day that Kennedy was assassinated, a communist Cuban CIA operative named Nestor Sanchez met with a high-level Cuban military officer in Paris to give him the tools needed to kill Castro. The weapon wasn't a gun, but a pen that contained a hypodermic needle filled with poison. Now, Castro was in Paris at the time, and by some accounts, meeting an American diplomat to discuss normalizing relationships between the two countries. Well, it was decided the mission of injecting Castro with that pen was a suicide mission, so the potential assassin suggested using a sniper rifle. And when they couldn't figure out how to get that accomplished, they just called it off. And news of Kennedy's assassination may have also put a temporary damper on the plot to kill Castro. Although, there are those that believe it was to be a double assassination that day. But in spite of everything, the CIA would not be deterred. Had plenty of resources, officers, and a lot of money, and a crazy idea left to try to kill the Cuban leader. Well, they dipped into its MKUltra goodie bag for a variety of poisons and drugs it planned to use on Castro. Various schemes came up to poison his tea and his coffee and other drinks, but once again, they had difficulties getting somebody close enough to perform the deed. They even considered spraying an aerosol laced with LSD on Castro before he gave a speech. Now, while it was believed the dose wouldn't have been fatal, it may have made him look like a blabbering fool on TV as he hallucinated. Of course, that didn't come to pass either. There were other crazy assassination plots that focused on the things he loved the most. Now, in spite of everything else, he was a hardcore Marxist and a hater of American Yankee imperialism, but he did love American baseball. Said to have been quite a player in his younger days, he even considered attempting a professional career, but instead he decided to become a guerrilla leader. But even as he was fighting in the Sierra Maestra Mountains in the late 50s, and after he became leader of Cuba, he continued his love of baseball. Well, the CIA used his love of baseball against him when they sent assassins to kill him with grenades at a baseball game in Havana. Unfortunately, the operation turned into a complete failure. You know, during World War II, since most Americans know how to throw a baseball, we developed hand grenades that looked like baseballs. And it was a program that had a lot of potential until the demonstrator threw the ball up in the air and caught it. Throwing it into the air armed it. Catching it set it off. Duh. Well, then they tried to use almost any man's weakness against Castro, and that was sex. When he met one of his many mistresses, Marita Lopez, in 1959, she had actually been sent by the CIA to kill him. Well, the details of how she got involved with CIA are a little sketchy, but what is certain is she had some poison pills in the cold cream jar that she planned to put in his food. Well, he became aware of the operation probably after the pills melted and her demeanor changed. She tried to figure out what to do next. Well, Castro decided to give her a way to accomplish her mission. Pulled out his pistol, handed it to her, told her to finish the job. She couldn't. Well, probably everybody's favorite failed CIA assassination plot involving Castro dealt with his love of cigars. They say that Cuban cigars are the best in the world. I saw them in New York City for $300-$400 each because they were illegal at the time. And they say Cuban cigars are actually the best, and there's no secret Castro loves cigars as much, if not more, than baseball and women. So when he visited the UN in New York City in 1960, the CIA thought up the idea of giving him a lethal cigar. Everyone loves a good exploding cigar gag, but the CIA planned to switch one of his Cubans for a cheap imitation laced with C4. Another potential plan was to lace one of his cigars with poison. In the end, none of these crazy assassination attempts even came close to killing him. Although there'll be hundreds of attempts on his life up into the 2000s, most after Kennedy's assassination weren't even sponsored by the CIA. They moved on to easier-to-kill targets, I guess. In the end, he had the last laugh. He died in 2016 at the age of 90, said to be of natural causes. Well, a lot of folks have been involved with the CIA that would surprise you. And we've seen the CIA's infiltrated a wide range of groups across the political spectrum. And in doing so, created some pretty interesting situations and bedfellows. Infiltration of some of the groups has created a situation where many people have rightfully questioned its influence in some political groups, or even the purpose of some political groups. For instance, did the CIA infiltrate some of these groups simply to keep tabs on them? Or did the CIA do so to discredit them through scandals and false flag operations? Of course, it's also possible the CIA infiltrated these groups with more complex long-term goals in mind. Some of the cases where their infiltrations become public, it's hard to say for sure, such as that of the feminist icon Gloria Steinem. Now, she's known for her rabble-rousing, bra-burning pro-feminist activism in the 60s and 70s, which made her a celebrity and one of the most revered figures on the New Left. But it was revealed in a 1979 article in the Liberal Village Voice that Gloria Steinem had at one time worked as a CIA asset, and she may very well have continued to be one. The article raised more than a few eyebrows with readers who had reasons to distrust the CIA. She was also a Playboy bunny. Go figure. Some thought it was slander and possibly disinformation from the CIA, while others, it made others question her entire life. For the most part, she's avoided answering questions about her potential work with the CIA. But the fact remains, she rubbed elbows with known CIA officers and front groups during a period when the agency had its hands in nearly every political organization in America. Of course, the question becomes, if she was in fact working for the CIA, what was her mission? There's never even been a modicum of information about that. You know, the saying is it takes all types, and it's as true for CIA assets as it is for anything else. As the CIA developed its vast network of leakers and snitches and unofficial spies over the years, it's gone out of its way to make sure that people from all walks of life are represented. They are an equal opportunity employer. They've had all races, men and women, all religions, all political persuasions. The CIA learned from its rival, the KGB, that there are plenty of ways to get a potential asset on board. With MKUltra, it was sexual blackmail and outright drugging. Appeals to greed in the form of cash payouts or lucrative jobs have also been used. And finally, the CIA has also appealed to many of its assets, patriotism or on other ideological grounds, particularly anti-communism. And based on all this, how feminist icon Gloria Steinem may have come to be a CIA asset may seem strange at first, but when you delve into it, it makes plenty of sense. She was born in 1934 in Toledo, Ohio, to a WASP mother and a Jewish father. Now, to be a ethnical Jew, the mother must be Jewish, not the father. Well, the father can be, but it comes down through the mother. Stano's father was usually gone on business as her mother suffered from mental health problems. When Stano's parents divorced when she was 10, she lived with her mother who had a difficult time making ends meet. Now, of course, Stano attributed this to sexism, but dedicated herself to rise above what she saw as the proverbial glass ceiling and by doing well and getting into a good college. When she graduated from high school, she achieved that goal by being accepted to not just any school, but the prestigious women's school, Smith College. And this is where her background gets interesting and where many people believe she was first recruited by the CIA. While she did well in high school, her family just didn't have the background or money for her to study at Smith. But she was sharp and apparently had support from some influential people because not only did she attend Smith College, she's also fast-tracked into career among the elites. As she graduated from Smith in 55, she was awarded a Chester Bowles Asian Fellow Scholarship to study in India for 2 years. But if you examine that scholarship program's history, in and of itself, it's something of a mystery. The man who the scholarship is named after and who presumably funded it was Chester Bowles, a political liberal who believed in improving the developing world through loans and volunteerism. And if you're wondering how somebody like this could have been connected to the more conservative CIA of the Cold War era, it's simply that the Cold War had its hands in all kinds of international aid organizations and NGOs, non-governmental organizations at the time, and still presumably does. Now, Bowles may have been a liberal, but he believed in the American government and its potential to carry out some of his ideas. So he regularly rubbed shoulders with members of the CIA and other intelligence agencies. When Gloria Steinem was awarded a fellowship in his name, it would be no surprise she was probably being groomed or interviewed for a more active role in the CIA. And interestingly enough, Steinem is the only known recipient of the Chester Bowles Asian Fellow Scholarship. That should tell you something. Just who Steinem may have been communicating with while she was in India may never be known, nor if she was recruited by the CIA before accepting the fellowship. But it isn't denied by anybody, including Steinem herself, that after she returned to the United States in 1958, she became actively working for the CIA. In 1958, CIA officer Cordon Meyer was running a CIA front group known as the Independent Research Service. The purpose of this organization was to bring together American academics, intellectuals, and journalists on the left wing of the political spectrum, ostensibly to steer them away from communism and Marxism. Steinem, in particular, was tasked with helping send non-communist representatives to the World Festival of Youth and Students of Vienna in 1959. Now, the World Youth Festival is a semi-regular festival that was intended to show global youth and socialist solidarity. It's commonly held in communist countries, so the event in non-communist Austria in 1959 was a pretty big deal. So if you think the CIA saw it as an opportunity, and as crazy as it might sound, how Gloria Steinem could help a monation, she was attractive, no question about that. She gave an interview in the late 60s that was for the most part forgotten until the Village Voice article was published in the 70s. In that interview, she admitted to being a CIA asset, claiming no strings attached to the agency's financial support for her participation in the 1959 World Youth Festival. She said, "The private individuals to whom I went often had particular points of view to put forward, which would have been much more restricting than the CIA funds. Were they free?" In the same interview, she then described how the CIA was nothing at all that she thought it was, and it was really just like the Peace Corps. She said, "I had the conventional liberals view the CIA as a right-wing incendiary group, and I was amazed to discover this was far from the case. They were enlightened, liberal, nonpartisan, activist sort who characterized the Kennedy administration, for instance." In that same interview, she claimed she hadn't worked for the CIA since 1962, going on to be a writer, editor, and full-time feminist activist. But in that same interview, she let something slip that exposed the confusing, duplicitous nature of the CIA and the crazy way in which they recruited people like her. When asked if her work with the CIA hurt her street cred with the New Left, she pointed out how she had protested the Vietnam War in front of Robert McNamara's office. He was Secretary of Defense in 61 through 68 and is largely seen as the architect of America's involvement in Vietnam. This doesn't precisely fit with the image of a CIA agent, she said, and then went on to complete that statement by saying, "But then neither does the CIA." The idea that Gloria Steinem was a CIA asset might seem crazy at first, But it didn't when you consider just how extensive CIA operations were in the 50s and 60s. She acknowledged she worked for the CIA, and that may be surprising to some, but in many ways it only adds more confusion and questions to her background. When did her involvement with CIA end? And either she had quit officially working for the CIA, did she lose her security clearance? Now that's a question that needs to be answered. Maybe the biggest question, why was Steinem recruited to the CIA in the first place? Was she legitimately recruited because, as she and others claim, she was a young, talented woman who happened to be at the right place at the right time to work for the CIA, which to her was a little more than another version of the Peace Corps, complete with idealistic liberal do-gooders running around with the sole intent to help the less fortunate? More cynical listeners, which is likely the majority, probably think Steinem was wound up and sent into the midst of the new left to spy on some of the more radical and violent members. And she may have served as effective controlled opposition, whereby the CIA controlled dissident groups such as Operation Chaos with their own officers. We'll probably never know the extent of her involvement with the CIA, but it's pretty strange to think the woman who led the second wave feminist movement may have been reporting everything to a handler. And certainly, it's something to keep in mind. You know, so far, most of the crazy CIA missions and characters associated with the agency that we've talked about have concerned the Soviet Union, its Eastern European allies, and Cuba. But in 1949, when Mao Zedong took power, the sleeping giant of China suddenly became the world's most populous communist nation. Situation threw the U.S. government and CIA into a tailspin. Another victory for the communist forces in the Cold War, which was something the folks at Langley weren't going to take sitting down. But the reality is nobody really knew what to do with China, and that included the Soviets. Yes, Mao proclaimed China to be a communist, socialist, communist state, but the more reports that leaked out of China in the 50s, looks less like anything people could understand. It's clearly a dictatorship that claimed to be communist, but in many ways it looked more like some ancient peasant society than the Soviet Union. At first, the U.S. kept communist China at arm's length, but then the Korean War broke out, which put China and the U.S. in direct conflict. The war ended in a stalemate, and although China was still clearly a backward country whose army was undersupplied, their sheer numbers were enough to frighten everybody in the American military-industrial complex. The only thing the Chinese were missing were nukes, but by the mid-60s, they were on the verge of getting those. The government tasked the CIA with spying on the Chinese nuclear program, and what following is one of the agency's strangest uses of technology, a listening device placed on one of the highest peaks in the world, which failed to be of any use to anybody. In 1954, the only things China and the Soviet Union had in common was their supposed commitments to Marxism, socialism, communism, and their practice of totalitarian government. Now, the Russians and the Chinese didn't have much in common culturally, and although much of the course of their long histories, they weren't really in contact. Contact between China and Russia became more common in the 1700s, and by the late 1800s, Russia was the stronger of the two nations and even opened ports and settlements in China. By the time Mao unified China under his rule, though, things had changed again and the border region became a bit contentious. Still, the Soviets agreed to lend materials, technology, and scientists to make a bomb to their communist counterparts. Or, I said a bomb, several bombs. Actually, Mao wasn't very greedy. He just wanted enough bombs to use as a threat to keep his country from being invaded by the Yankee imperialist Americans. But in an ironic twist of geopolitics, after 59, China's new nuclear arsenal was more likely to be used on the Soviet Union or India. Mao claimed the Soviets weren't being communist enough, so in 1959 he made it known to the world that he and the Chinese Communist Party would go their own way, and any socialist nature in good standings were free to go with them. And they were taking their bombs with them. Well, the U.S. government found itself in a bit of an intelligence pickle when the Chinese government performed its first nuclear weapons test in 1964. The pace at which the Chinese went from being a nearly completely agrarian society to nuclear power was impressive, to say the least. A little too impressive for the governments of America and India. As much as we wanted to keep tabs on all the other nuclear powers, especially those professing undying loyalty to communism, the Indians didn't want to see Chinese power grow either. China and India had their own border conflict over the Himalayan mountains region, so when Chinese got the bomb, put a sense of urgency into the Indian Intelligence Bureau, which is India's version of the CIA. So the CIA and the Indian Intelligence Bureau decided to collaborate on a mission to spy on China's burgeoning nuclear weapons program. What if the two agencies didn't effectively cooperate? I mean, they did, but obtaining intelligence became a major hurdle. So the CIA looked at the tried and true methods of using officers in the field. And this sort of worked in the USSR for a number of reasons. Despite technically being a closed society, the USSR did allow a sizable number of outsiders to visit and sometimes even work and live in the country. And most of USSR was in Europe, so the people had a long tradition of being part of Europe and had, by the 1960s, developed ties across the continent that transcended the Iron Curtain. But in the 1960s, China was a truly closed and foreign country. It's been very difficult to send Chinese-American spies into China. Attempting to turn Chinese citizens was seen as a futile exercise. So sending officers into China wasn't a possibility in 65. What about spy satellites? They worked great, but the technology just wasn't there in the mid-60s. The space race at that time between the Soviet Union and the U.S. was less than 10 years old, which meant the CIA had to look elsewhere. That's when one of the CIA geniuses said, hey, what about all those big mountains in the Himalayas? So they came up with the idea of putting a listening device on a Himalayan mountain that was close enough to the Chinese border and high enough to intercept Chinese radio signals. After doing some investigating, the CIA came up with a mountain called Nanda Devi and began what was known as Operation Hat. Well, we're going to talk more about Operation Hat in our next show. For right now, we're out of time. So until tomorrow at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.